This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Yes, I think, thanks. What I'm going to do is just briefly summarize the main points from last time, which was our first shiur in Rut, and then move into the second shiur. And one of the important points we commented on the interesting elements about the book, the fact that the heroes are women, apart from Boaz to some extent, but certainly the active heroes, even Boaz is a little bit passive in the process. The active heroes are certainly women, which is one of the reasons that it's such a fascinating limud for women. We talked about the fact that why it's learnt on Shavuos, and we talked about the fact that there was the struggle and the suffering and the understanding that Torah is not something that can be gained without an investment of enormous effort, and with that comes a great deal of pain. And the pain and pathos of the story is intimated at in the very first word, which is Vayahi, and we talked about the Chazal, that the phonetic meaning of Vayahi is a tone of pathos, of Oyvei, and there's a kind of a whining sound to the word Vayahi, so that whenever Vayahi does appear in the Torah, we learn that it's referring to something, to some form of suffering. And that here, in fact, in the first sentence, Vayahi appears twice. Vayahi bimei shvot ha-shoftim, Vayahi rav ba'aretz. We commented also, and in this I'm using as a basis, as we will, as we work our way through the book, a commentary by a cousin of mine, Rabbi Aviel Orenstein, Nailer Agli, which is a fascinating commentary where he weaves in the Chazal, the various midrashic material, into an understanding of the Book of Rut. And he points out that Vayahi doesn't only signify suffering. If we look at the first time the word Vayahi appears in Tanakh, you remember we said it was in Bereishis when God said, "Let there be," and there was Vayahi. Yehi or Vayahi or. Implying a certain inevitability, just as at that time when God said let there be, it was inevitable that there would be. There's no gap between God's instruction and the actualization of that, and therefore Vayahi implies an inevitability, and the inevitability here is, and it was at the time of the Shvot HaShoftim that there was a famine in the land, and we explored quite carefully that linkage, that inevitable linkage. What is it about the time of Shvot HaShoftim which led to a Rav, which led to a famine in the land? And we talked about Shvot HaShoftim being as a time where judges, where people judge the judges. It was quite interesting to me that somebody mentioned to me this week that it was interesting to see Senator Kennedy judge Alito. Here's a man who we know was either a murderer or a manslaughterer, and did the kind of thing for which normal people go to jail, and he's sitting there judging the ethics of a man who appears to have been a very upright and ethical man. When nobodies are judging the judges. And we commented last time how we're living in this period of Shvot HaShoftim, but that judging the judges doesn't just mean in that sense of formal judges. We're all judges. We all judge each other, and that's how we progress. That's how we that's how society progresses. That's how individuals progresses. If nobody judges a student, a kid is at school, and nobody judges his performance, how does he develop? He doesn't develop. If you're in business and your supervisor isn't judging your performance, how do you develop? If you're a business owner and your shareholders aren't judging your performance, how do you develop? You don't develop anywhere if you're not being judged. So Shvot HaShoftim, when you judge your judges, what you really are doing are escaping judgment. And we talked about our society, and particularly in the United States, that this is almost an unwritten law that we don't judge each other. that as long as we don't hurt each other, we don't judge each other. And what that does to a society, if we're living in a society where we don't judge each other, that's because we don't like to face the discomfort of judgment. It's very, very, it's painful if a friend says, you know, what you did disappointed me, what you did let me down. I don't think what you did was right. It's uncomfortable, and we don't like it. So we shvot shoftim. So we hire rabbis who don't judge us, and we get friends that don't judge us, and we don't judge our friends, and so we live in the comfort of being left alone. And that results, we said last time, in what did we say? If you surround yourself with people who don't judge you, what are those relationships? Remember last time?
You feel there's a spiritual lack.
But why? You're right, because we said those relationships are inauthentic. You can't have an authentic relationship if you can't express judgment. So if you have to walk around each other very carefully and you say to your friend, do you think I'm looking good in this dress that I just bought? And they've got to say yes, because if they say no, they're judging you, and you don't want to be judged. So is that authentic? No. So they've got to say, this is what I did or said. Do you think I was right? And what your friend knows is all you want to hear is, yes, you were right. So they say, yes, you were right. But that's not authentic. So when we surround ourselves with people who we don't allow to judge us, we're surrounding ourselves with relationships that are not authentic. And the inauthentic doesn't nourish. The inauthentic doesn't satisfy. Artificiality doesn't nourish and satisfy. And that creates ra'av. Ra'av doesn't only mean a physical famine. Chazal says it's the vayihi twice is to imply two types of famine. There was physical famine, and there was also spiritual famine. And all of that is a result of Shvot HaShoftim, living in a time of artificiality, in a time of inauthenticity, inauthentic relationships, in an inauthentic life, creates a sense of Rav. Because Rav doesn't only mean the absence of food. Rav also means the inability to be sustained by food, the inability to be nourished by food. And we see that in our time too. And we commented last time that although we're living in a time of great material abundance, it's my contention that we're living in a time of terrible famine. Because it's not that there isn't food available, but the food is not nourishing us. And that's clearly evidenced by the volume of food people are eating. If food was nourishing, people would eat little. When people are eating these enormous amounts, it's because the food isn't nourishing. And relationships are nourishing, and spirituality is nourishing. And we talked last time about how we see people desperately seeking nourishment, and they're seeking nourishment in all areas, even in the material. It's one thing to say that in the spiritual area people are seeking nourishment, we know that, but it's even in the material area people are seeking nourishment and eating and eating and eating and consuming and consuming. That's the sign of a desperate person who isn't really finding nourishment. And so that's the setting of the time. It was a time of when the Jewish people were being led by judges, not by kings yet, but the people were judging their judges. That meant not only in terms of the judicial system, but even in terms of relationships. That meant people stopped judging. And when people stop judging one another, relationships are inauthentic and artificial. And when relationships are artificial, it is inevitable then that there will be a ra'av ba'aretz, and it is inevitable then that there will be a it's inevitable that there will be famine and that there will be a lack of nourishment, if we define famine as lack of nourishment, not lack of food. And we said in fact the word ra'av comes from the word ra'av, which means hunger. It's not in English when we talk about famine, you're talking about the absence of food, you're talking about the object. In Hebrew, the word ra'av is in the subject. Ra'av means ra'av, the people are hungry. That doesn't mean that necessarily that there isn't food. It could also mean the food is not nourishing. So it's in that time. I see nobody brought roots this time. You've got a copy. Great. Okay. So now let's get into the second part of the sentence. And a very subtle implication in the second part of the sentence. Vayelech ish mi beit lechem Yehuda, And a man went from Beit Lechem Yehuda, Lagur Bistei Moav, to dwell in the fields of Moav, who the Ishto, he and his wife, Ushnei Vanov, and his two children. We're not yet told the names. We're told about a demographic movement of a certain family. And let's just analyze what it tells us here. It was a man from Beit Lechem Yehuda. What do those words conjure up in your mind? Beit Lechem, what do you think of?
A house of bread
is what it means. Interesting, a time of famine. Beit Lechem, what do you think of it?
Food.
Sorry? Rachel. Beit Lechem is Rachel. That's where Rachel's buried. Beit Lechem, we think of Rachel. And Yehuda? We think of Yehuda, obviously. When you think of Rachel, and there are many things that one can think about Rachel, what are some of the things that come to mind?
The
case of the Didaim. Anything else? What other stories come to mind with Rachel? Giving her sister the password comes to mind, because that was probably the event that most changed her life, not to her advantage. So an enormous act of chesed, of giving out. She gave away not just money, she gave away everything. She gave away her future so that her sister shouldn't become embarrassed. That's Rachel. What about Yehuda? What comes to mind in a similar vein?
Tamar.
What aspect of Tamar?
Same.
Wouldn't embarrass her. So he gave away his life and reputation rather than damage Tamar. So here we have two people, a man and a woman, Rachel and Yehuda, who gave everything away to help and as an act of chesed. What about this man who leaves Beit Lechem Yehuda and comes to Sedei Moav? Why did he do that, and what was his case? Well, we're told he was an Ish. When the Torah uses the word Ish, that usually means man with a capital M. This was a man. This was somebody really important. And Rashi says, based on the Midrash, Ashir Gadol Hayo Fanas Hador. He was a very wealthy man and a leader of the generation. This was one of the great people of the generation in Eretz Israel at that time. So this is no ordinary man, ordinary story. Vayetzei me'Eretz Israel l'chutz la'aretz, and he left Israel. Why? What was going on? We know there was a famine, but he was a wealthy man. He wasn't suffering from the famine. So why did he leave? Why did he emigrate?
He had too much responsibility.
Yes, mipnei tzarus ha'ayin, because he had a narrow eye. He was resentful about the poor people who overwhelmed him with requests for donations. So here he was, a wealthy man, one of the few people who had resources, in a community suffering enormous famine, being overwhelmed with requests for help. So he didn't want to say no. He couldn't stand seeing their suffering. So he withdrew from the situation. He moved away. Look at the contrast between that and Rachel and Yehuda on the other hand. What do we see here? Almost the hero and the anti-hero, isn't that so? You see courage and absolute generosity, giving away their essence, both in the case of Yehuda. What did Yehuda have that was his most precious asset? Was his reputation. Yehuda was the king. Yehuda was the most precious asset that Yehuda had was his reputation. He gave that away to save Tamar. What did Rachel have? What was her most precious asset? Her future marriage to Yaakov. She gave that away to save embarrassment to her sister Leah. What is this man from Beit Lechem Yehuda got? He's got money. God blesses him with material assets. And that he's not willing to give away. He must have given a lot. He must have given a lot of stock, but it came to a point where he becomes overwhelmed. And Rashi adds, "Lekachne enash." That's why he's punished. He's not punished for emigrating. He's not punished for leaving Israel. There are times when you have to do that. He's punished for the reason why. Why did he leave? Because he couldn't face the suffering. So, is that a positive or a negative characteristic?
Positive.
A man can't face the suffering of other people, so he goes away. Sorry? There's something positive in that. He's not saying, I can't live with this, I can't face it. He's a sensitive being who cannot live with the impact of that suffering. And so he pulls away from it.
But it's
a weakness.
It's a huge weakness. I don't see it as a strength at all, because he's not then the man with a capital M. Because somebody who is a man says, I'm going to do it anyhow, even if it hurts.
Overcomes
and even if it's so upsetting to me to see all this, but I'm going to give it till I'm penniless.
Now let's say
he
that
didn't
he couldn't
want to give away all of his money.
Well, let's say that might be, but that might have been what one of the things prevented him from staying was that he didn't want to give away his money. It might be that he was afraid that even giving all his money is not going to help. This is so huge, it's so much bigger than one man, and maybe he did give all his money, and really what he goes away from, Chazal tell us, is he couldn't stand to see the suffering. Then he becomes helpless. It's almost a sense of helplessness. I can't really help. Give a bit of money to these people. Eventually I'm going to run out. That's not going to save the nation. And I can't suffer to see the suffering, so I'm going somewhere else. What else could he have done? What are we meant to do when we're surrounded with suffering and we can't help?
You have to become creative and get people to then work together to create something out of that suffering. That
okay.
must have been his job. And
let's say you can't.
Home.
Let's say you go to India and you see millions upon millions upon millions of...
But then you have to just start from that small place. And then create.
You see, you hid in the hotel room because you couldn't stand it.
I needed
isn't that
a little
right?
time. I needed to hide.
You can't take it. There comes a point where you can't take it. It's just so overwhelming. You know, we're not used to seeing that. We're used to, ten mishulachim came to knock on my door last night. Okay, big deal. 10 mishulachim came. 20 mishulachim. So what? Compared to a situation like India, where you walk in the streets and they're knocking on the door of your car and they're lining the streets and their hands are wherever you look, all there's nothing you can do. It's not possible to do it. And your guide is telling you, ignore them, just ignore them. Don't even try and help them. It's hopeless. So you're surrounded by absolute hopelessness and enormous human suffering. And what do? Do you give all your money away, but just a little penny here and a penny there, and then you've got nothing, and nor has anybody else got anything? Is that what you do, or do you?
How about giving to one person?
Get one person going, and then what do you do with everybody else? How do you cope emotionally? Him leaving doesn't do anything either, but at least it enables him to get on with his own life.
It makes everything worse because he's the guy that they respect, and he's the guy that everyone's looking to help them.
Well, what I want to get to really is what is expected of a person in a case of suffering that he cannot or she cannot alleviate. What do? You're with a fatally ill person. But in a case where even that you can't, the person is dying, you're with somebody who's dying, what can you do?
Help them understand why it's all happening so they can make sense of it.
Just be there. That being there, we underestimate the value of being there, of just being present, praying. If we really believe in tefillah, that can motivate enormous depths of tefillah. We know that pain motivates tefillah. It doesn't have to be your own pain. Sometimes if we don't use other people's pain to motivate our tefillah, God brings us our own pain, because God wants to hear that tefillah. And nothing motivates tefillah like pain. And if we are able to identify with the pain of other people and convert that energy into, instead of a paralyzing energy, so let's look what happens. You see pain, let's look at our own pain. We know that pain galvanizes us into action. Well, sometimes it paralyzes, but generally it galvanizes us into action. We're hungry, we go and get something to eat. We've run out of money, we'll try and make a plan. We're feeling a pain in our bodies, we go to a doctor or we do something about it. We respond to pain. What about pain in other people? Exactly the same thing. There's an energy in pain. Pain is a generator of energy. Pain is not a sapper of energy. We tend to think, we try to escape pain. And again, one of the things we commented on last time is in this generation of Shvat HaShoftim, it all results from the fact that one of our biggest values in life, and again, particularly in the United States, is comfort. I would claim that the value, America, the greatest American value is not freedom anymore. That used to be an American value. It's not human dignity. That used to be an American value. It's not democracy. That used to be an American value. The greatest American value is comfort. People will make sacrifice for comfort. And comfort is the alleviation of pain. But pain is a generator of energy. Comfort isn't. Comfort generates no energy. Comfort is comfort. It's a blessing. It's wonderful to have comfort, but it doesn't generate energy. Pain does. And in our effort to alleviate pain, we're actually alleviating one of the sources of energy. Now, that source of energy doesn't have to be our own pain. It can be other people's pain. If we feel the pain and do something with that pain, we can translate that into action. So the one thing, if somebody's poor, we translate it into an act of chesed, into an act of tzedakah. That's fine. That's one thing. What happens if we can't do that? We don't have the power to do that. We now have the choice of being blind to the pain and desensitizing ourselves, or of taking that pain still and converting it into something positive. That something positive doesn't have to be tzedakah. It can be chesed. And chesed doesn't cost anything. And chesed, sometimes just the mere presence, the fact that I'm present, the fact that I'm there with you, the fact that I acknowledge. Often in counseling, it's talked about so often. If somebody tells you about their tzoris, what is your response meant to be? If somebody tells you about terrible things that are going on in their life and they're suffering and this is doing, what do they want from you?
Just to get
another human being that gets it. And even sometimes in relationships, a friend or a spouse doesn't need you to resolve it. Men find that difficult to understand sometimes with women, that women are. You don't have to solve it. I'm not telling you about this because I need a solution. I'm telling you about this because I need to tell you about it, and I need you to hear about it. That's all. And there's huge comfort in somebody else being present. And noisei ba'olim chaveru, we say sharing the burden. Sharing the burden doesn't mean that you solve it. It just means you feel the pain. And being able to do that is enormously powerful. That's what Elimelech was punished for. Not for the fact that he didn't give the tzedakah. He might not have had the resources to give a whole lot more than he was giving. That's not necessarily what he was criticized for, but the running away from it rather than the engaging in it is the anti-heroic action that he did. So Vayelech Ish, this man went from Beit Lechem Yehuda, Lagur b'Sdei Moav. Why Sdei Moav of all places? Why did he choose Moav? What comes to mind when you think of Moav? The only nation that's not allowed to marry in, not allowed to convert, because of their lack of chesed. When we needed water, they didn't respond. All we needed was water. It didn't cost them anything. So you've got the same thing. We weren't asking of their inability to respond to suffering. So he goes to Moab, probably feeling, I don't feel indebted to them. So he's choosing a society in which he feels no indebtedness. That's one society I don't owe anything to. So I don't have to worry if there's poverty there, if there's suffering there. It's not my business. They chose not to have a relationship with us. They chose not to engage in empathy and in sympathy. And so he deliberately chooses Sdei Moav as a place to escape a sense of responsibility to society. He didn't want to. He'd had enough of that. He just needed his space, and he went to Sdei Moav for the field, not even to a city. And we can just see the desperation in the man, the need to escape communal responsibility and just get to a place where nobody would expect anything of him or from him. I always say Los Angeles is a little bit like that. It's kind of a city that doesn't really expect anything from you, kind of lets you get on with your life.
And you left your family back there. Nobody knows you.
Like, you know, people that come here seem to... There's much less social responsibility, you know, in a way here, and communal responsibility here than in many other cities. And that's what Elimelech was seeking, was an existence of zero communal responsibility, having come from a life of enormous communal responsibility. Who goes? Hu v'ishto, he and his wife, u'shnei vonov, and his two sons. The listing of the people who went makes it clear also as to who the primary motivator was. He went, and with him came his wife and his children, but it was his decision to go. And only now are we told the Shem Ha'ish, and the name of the man was Elimelech. What does the word Elimelech mean? Sorry?
God, my God is my king.
What could it be? Elimelech, my God is my king. What else could it be? Elimelech.
Oh, I'm king.
Yes, royalty to me. So he was a man who craved to become king of Israel. That was his ambition. Mm-hmm. And that's why he took on such enormous responsibility in the community and society at that time. But the fact that he wasn't able to sustain, he was being tested, obviously. He took on enormous responsibility, but God kind of pushed the boundaries to see how he would react to the turning on the screws of that responsibility, because a melech has to be able to carry the nation through no matter what, and be able to handle their drawing on him, their dependency on him, their need of him. And Elimelech cracked, and he couldn't handle it. He couldn't support them, nor could he turn them away and show insensitivity. He just collapsed. He just couldn't handle it, and off he went. V'shem Ishto Naomi, his wife was Naomi, and Shnei Vonov and his two sons were Machlon V'chilia. Those are interesting names. What do they mean? Machlon and Kilion are both names that imply kind of destruction. Just they left with nothing, because they left nothing behind them eventually. They left no impact in the world. They too were great people, but they themselves left no impact. Ephratim, they came from Ephrat, again Mibes Lechem Yehuda, emphasizing where do these people came from? They came from Beit Lechem Yehuda, the area that was known for its chesed, the area that was really built on principles of chesed, and they collapsed from an inability to be able to continue with the chesed. Vayavo Sadeh Moav, and they came to the fields of Moav, Vayihi Yusham, and they were there. It's interesting when it says they came there. That's not telling us a geographical fact that they arrived by Avos Sadeh Moav. It's really the opposite of the case that we've got. We have it in Bereishis a few times. We have it here as well when it says, for example, Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva, and Yaakov went out from Be'er Sheva. What did Chazal tell us? The reason we're told that he left Be'er Sheva, although we know that it's clear that he left Be'er Sheva, is he left a void behind. But when a tzaddik leaves a city, he leaves a void. You notice the absence. And that's really, everybody should be that way. If you can leave a place, whether it's a building or a meeting of people or a shul or whatever, if you can leave a place and not and the your departure is not noticed, we have a problem. If you can leave a place and it's not noticed, then what were you contributing? So the Vayetze is a really important indication of the void that is left when an individual departs. Vayavo is the opposite. Vayavo, Sadeh Moav, their coming to Sadeh Moav was noticed. Their coming to Sadeh Moav left a huge impression, created an impression. There was the addition of something valuable. What would that have been? That even though they were in a place like Moav, they remained faithful to their moral system. They didn't in any way adopt the Moabite moral system. They remained faithful to it, and they contributed and made a difference to the city, to the place. By Yiyushom, and they were there, they lived there, they made that their place. So now what happens? First thing that happens after a period of time, by Yom Haselim Melech Ishnomi, he dies. What does that tell us? As you're looking at the story, what is the story telling us?
You run away from where he could have had impact, and immediately he dies because everything got sucked out of him. There was no more. In order to keep surviving and living, you need to give out.
That's it. That's important. You need a purpose for living. You need a purpose. You need to be making a contribution. His escape from his purpose was, in fact,
his death.
And that's why you find so often that people who go into retirement go into health decline. When there's no real reason for it should be the time that's healthiest for them, when they don't have the hassles of work, when they can take it easy. The proportion of people who go into health decline very soon after that is enormous. One of the, you know, what's really interesting is we do a lot of work with police departments, as you know, and the retirement benefits in the police force, particularly in California, but it's all over the country, are enormously high. They can retire in their mid-40s with their full salary and enormous benefits for the rest of their lives. And many of them go into the police force for that very reason. They work for 20 years and they retire for the rest of their lives with full benefits and their families after it and so on. And when I question who's paying for this? How is that possible? I know that we are, but what's the math? How does this work? How is it possible to offer that kind of benefit? The answer is they don't survive long after they leave.
Oh.
The police officers have the highest mortality rate after retirement of any profession.
Even the shortest. Young?
So then my question was, does the age make a difference? And the interesting thing was, no. It makes no difference. The mortality rate, the number of years, the average number of years after retirement before a police officer dies is the same if he dies at 45 or if he retires at 45 or at 55 or at 60, which means it has nothing to do with his age or with his health. So what is it? So after a life of power and contribution and everybody needs me and all that, all of a sudden, overnight, they're nobody. We have a sense of that here. Elimelech running away from what he perceived to be as a drain on his resources, not realizing that the giving out is in fact the greatest provider of resource. It's not the other way around. We tend to think we're giving out, we're losing. That's not okay. That's why we live. That's the source of our life. So Elimelech, who kind of saw his purpose as potentially becoming the king, and built this ability to be able to give and to sustain, finally just can't take it anymore and drops out of it, and he dies. Why we told Ish Naomi? We know he's Naomi's husband. Vayamat Elimelech Ish Naomi.
She was a great lady.
Yeah,
but related to him.
She was a great lady, but then why are we told here when he died?
Did she take on a manly kind of part because she now is running everything? Not a manly order, but because she becomes very strong, or more strong from what she was.
That's all possible. The what's interesting in Chazal here is what Chazal say is that's okay. And in many times we realize why. Who suffers as a result of that death? Don't forget they're isolated in Moab. They haven't built a society. They haven't built a community. Mm-hmm. They're isolated. And Elimelech goes. That has enormous impact on Naomi. What has she got left? So this is not just a blow to Elimelech, this is a blow to Naomi. So what should Naomi's reaction be? What should she be doing now?
She should be depressed.
So she should be saying, why? Why has this happened? What's the message? And if she would have done that, what would be her conclusion?
To go back to Israel?
Would have to be to say it was wrong of us to come, that Elimelech, a healthy man, dies all of a sudden. Why is it he's not making a contribution? We should go back to where we can make it. She fails to do that, and in the next phrase we're told, Vatishoer hi ushnei vonehah. She and her two sons remain. That's the tragedy, that she doesn't get the message. Now that they remain, we see the tragedy continuing to unfold. Vayisu lahem nashim u'avios. Now they start becoming more entrenched. They realize they are there to stay. So the two sons marry Moabite women. Shem ha'achas Orpah v'shem ha'sheni Rut. One was Orpah, one was Rut. By Yeshu Shom, and they settled there. They lived there. That's the first time we're told Vayeshvu. You notice they went Lagur, Vayiyu Sham. This was the first time we're faced, we see the word Vayeshvu, which is they tried to settle there. For the first time they decided to settle, which is exactly the opposite response of what God would have wanted from the message he was giving. Elimelech comes to Moab, God takes him away. The thought process should be, well, let's try and re-engineer our lives, let's try and reposition ourselves. Clearly what we're doing is not what God wants us to do. Instead they settle themselves further, and that's what pain does. Sometimes pain mobilizes us, as we said. Sometimes pain energizes us into action and into making change, and sometimes makes us close in even more. And that's what they were doing. They closed themselves in. Vayeshvu shom ke'eser shonim, and they dwelt there for some 10 years. What happens next? Vayomusu gam shnehem. They also die. And what does also mean? The Medrash says and Rashi says. Sorry.
For the same reason they die.
Well, there's some of that is for the same reason, but it's also says Rashi, "Bitchila loku b'mamoinon." First, they lost their money, u'mesu gemaleihem u'miknehem, and then they lost their camels and cattle. V'achakach mesu gamhem, and then they also died. That also means they were the last thing to die. So there was a process taking place, and Chazal say that's the way God tries to bring a message. He starts far out, and he hurts you at the periphery of your life. And if you don't get the message, it comes a little closer, so that you can see the trend, and you can see that this is a message, something's happening here, there's movement. And we see that in a number of different places, and one of them is in the area of Negoim. Do you remember that in the Torah when it talks about the various different plagues that can affect a person? And it starts off with the house gets tzaraat, and then the clothing gets tzaraat, and then the person gets tzaraat. You see the movement from the outside in, starting with material possessions to the family, the individual, and life itself then gets threatened. So there's been, through this 10 years, there was a process, and they weren't getting the message. The process was Elimelech is gone, your money's gone, your cattle has died, and now finally Machlon and Chilion die as well. Batisha'er ha'isho mishnei yelodeho me'isho. And the woman remained now bereft of her two children and her husband. She now has nothing. So Naomi finally looks at her life and realizes they left Israel because they were afraid of having nothing. They came to Moab and she's got nothing. Whereas had they stayed in Israel, the worst that would have happened is they would have lost their money, but she would have had her family. As they moved, she's lost everything. She doesn't have family, she doesn't have money, she doesn't have a husband, she has nothing. Why is she responsible? What could she have done? What is she responsible for?
Is there something she could have done?
So that's the question. Because she seems to be being held to some degree responsible for what? She followed her husband. That's what a good wife should do. He wants to emigrate, she emigrated. What?
I've always learned that a wife has an inordinate amount of impact on her husband, and she did not have impact on her husband to leave. Why was she not strong enough or have some impact to say, at least kind of have a vision of what it would be like future? Women don't think like that a whole lot. I mean, like really kind of to see it out, but she had none. She didn't think about what would it be like down the road for my children, at least. That my husband's suffering fine. You know, I mean, like, you know, she didn't say, maybe you're being tested, maybe these things. And what is the lesson of this? And maybe you should just see what you can learn from here. Why are we moving to a place where you won't have any responsibility? You know that that's not good for you.
So what you're absolutely right. What she's criticized of not doing and could have done is combating his tzarut ayin. His tzarut ayin was his narrowness of vision, the fact that he couldn't stand the calls on himself. He wanted to escape the need to contribute. She could have combated that. and helped, and let's understand why that is. What could she have done, and what's the learning point from there? Certainly from a woman perspective, what could she have done? So he's the businessman, he's the leader, he's the visionary, and he sees that in his position as leader of the community, he's being completely drained of all his resources and energy and assets, and therefore he wants to go. She could say, let's not go, but he's suffering. He's in a situation, he's suffering. What could and should she have done that she wasn't doing?
Maybe she told him what he wanted to hear, like what you said before about an authentic relationship.
Maybe she was part of Shvat HaShoftim, but she understood that he didn't want to be judged, and so she didn't judge him, and that she's being held responsible for. That's a really nice idea, that links right into the opening, to the opening phrase, that he's, because Chazal say, Hayom b'yoda limchis v'lo imicho, she had the ability to object and she didn't, and that's exactly right.
It's okay to object to your husband.
Absolutely, it's okay when he's doing something that isn't right. But let's look at the particular nature of what was going wrong here, because that's quite interesting. What is he suffering? Enormous output and no input. What could she have done?
She didn't create something at home, a safe haven. There wasn't something safe there.
It would appear that she failed to nourish him sufficiently to be able to urge him to continue giving. It's okay, there's plenty more, we've got the resources. That's something that a woman can be particularly good at. That as he feels drained, and that's of course one of the big problems of homes where both parents have to work, or both parents choose to work, is that both are being drained on the outside and come home drained, and they feed on each other, but they've got nothing to give because they're both drained. The family model operates on that somebody has the resources to be able to refresh and revitalize the drained one. Sometimes it works the other way around. Sometimes he comes home all energized and excited from an interesting day at work, and she's just been hassling with the children all day, so she's the one who feels drained. And one has to look at that. It's not the intention of Chazal that a woman feels drained at home, but that part of her role is to be able to nourish him sufficiently so that his output doesn't deplete. And the fact that Elimelech is so depleted is a function, it would appear, not only on the calls on his resources from society, but also on a failure of Naomi to nourish. And that's why she suffers.
But I remember learning that they missed her a lot too, so she must have been out there doing a lot of chesed herself.
I'm sure she was, but her
maybe she drained from it.
Maybe her role was more to be feeding into Elimelech rather than doing the chesed directly outside. And that is the Vayamos Elimelech Ish Naomi, that his death is related to her. And it's related to their relationship. Vayamos Elimelech Ish Naomi, the husband of Naomi, is the one who died. Implying that she, in her role as wife, maybe didn't fulfill her potential to the degree that she should have. And so ultimately she's left alone. She's the least responsible. She's the survivor. She's the least responsible. Elimelech dies, the sons die. The fact, though, that she's left alone, and you've got this... What you now see really is Naomi as the heroine, and all these circles around her having been taken away. So it's almost as if it's being portrayed in such a way that she is destined to be the hero, but she's got to look inward. She's got to look in at herself and say, what could I have been doing differently? What can I do differently? And to be able to move forward from there.
Well, you can see the other way around. Vayamat Elimelech Ish Naomi, as a man of Naomi, he died. He died as a man of Naomi. Maybe he was the one who was not a husband.
That's also nice.
When he was away in the last part of him. He was drained, that's why he wasn't a husband, that's why he died as a man of her.
So that's a nice idea. You're saying that possibly he too, and the reason that he went first is because he failed, that he failed her in that relationship. Mm-hmm. Not only did she fail him in that relationship earlier, but later on when they were in the Sdei Moav, it might have been he who was failing her in his relationship as husband of Naomi. It's a very nice idea. I just want to open the next sentence and then we'll carry it on next week. Vatakom hi v'chalotea. So finally she gets galvanized into action. And she and her daughters-in-law get up. And just look at the trope, those of you who've got a sofa in front of you. Vatoshov misdei Moav. And she returned. There are a few linguistic interests here. The one is, when you say, and a person returned, what do you expect the next phrase to be?
To.
I returned to. Tzad says returned from. And secondly, if you look at the trope, what's under Vatashov? Do you see it's like it's a tipko, which is a closed bracket. So it's not saying Vatashov Misdei Moav, and she returned from Misdei Moav, it's saying Vatakum Hibichalotah Vatashov. That's the end of the phrase. She and her daughters-in-law get up Vatashov. What does that mean? They did tshuva. So here you've got the turning point. At last she gets it. She gets the message, this is a time for tshuva. And what we're going to move into now is their journey home. Not just their journey to their geographical home, but her journey to her spiritual home. The fact that she has drifted, the fact that she recognizes that she and her family has drifted, and Vatakum, she gets up to begin her journey home to do teshuva, and to redirect her life and to redirect her family. And again, next week we'll go into what exactly motivated that, how did she get that point, where is she going, and how does she plan to get there.
When it says they did teshuva, does that mean the two girls or one girl?
We're going to see, but certainly her. Vatashuv is she did teshuva.
She did.
So that's where it starts. She gets up with her daughters-in-law and she does teshuva. And if we learn Vatashuv as she does teshuva, then what does Misadei Moav mean? That what instigated the teshuva was actually the Sadei Moav. That's where it all starts. This process, this journey, actually she drew on the Sadei Moav experience to begin the journey and the process of teshuva, which is now going to go into.